Well, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. One of those days, left my glasses home today. That's not good. You know what I mean? That's all right. We'll live without it. But then my sermon notes never showed up on my computer today. All right. We can live with that too, right? So it's Prairie Home Companion today. You know what I mean? And I'm just going to talk with you a little bit about a very important subject, and that subject arises naturally from Parashat Yitro. Yitro, oh, Jesus, in a moment, on top of everything else. It's from Parashat Yitro. And it has to do with the subject of how we all need more than just knowledge about God, but how we all need to encounter him. That's what I'm talking with you about today. Now, let us not trivialize the importance of knowledge about God. A lot of people claim all kinds of things about their relationship with God, and you look at their actions and you go, hokey smokes, you know, how could that really be? Knowledge of God is important, and people claim all kinds of stuff that I would not affirm necessarily as coming from the throne of heaven, but we understand that to be true. However, at the end of the day, it's not just knowledge about him. It is encountering him. This is actually captured most beautifully, I think, in the Shacharit service, not on Shabbat, because we don't lay tefillin on Shabbat, but for Jewish guys, and I think according to our halakha, Jewish women also may do this, and that is the wearing of the tefillin, you know. And when you put tefillin on, it's tactile, you feel it. It's something that you wrap yourself up in, and has tremendous value in that regard. I'm telling you, the tactile sensation is very supportive emotionally, if you will, and spiritually, of the words that you're saying. But you wrap the strap around your finger, and you say words about knowing, and you shall know the Lord. God speaking to this to Israel. You shall know the Lord. Not that you shall know about him, but that you shall know him. Do you get my drift about that this morning? Really is a big deal. So let's consider the Parashat Yitro. And it's interesting, Parashat Yitro, most of the parashas are named after the first few words in the text. And sometimes you have special parashas related to holidays. But here we have Parashat Yitro. It's named after a pagan priest. Isn't that interesting? He was a Midianite priest. So here's the situation. Midian, northeast Saudi Arabia. And it is my conviction, and I'm happy to tell you why another time. I don't want to take the time now, that Mount Sinai was not in the Sinai Peninsula. And there were some very good reasons for believing that was not the place. It's a tradition that goes back to the 3rd century of our era, started by some monks, essentially, that this particular place in the Sinai was where Mount Sinai was. But I'd like to suggest it probably was in northeast Saudi Arabia. And Jethro was the high priest of that area, the Midianites, and he functioned that area. And there was a place called the Mountain of God. And this is the place to which Moses returned with our people. And the Mountain of God, I would make the case that it was probably an active volcano that our people had never seen before, and that God used the a combination of supernatural and natural things, often all happening providentially, to make a huge impression on our people. We'll get to that in a minute. But we're talking about knowing God, not just knowing about him. And here you have Yitro, and according to the tradition, Yitro, when he sees what God had done for Israel, and there's debates among the rabbis as to exactly what he saw. Rashi says that what he saw was the beating of the Amalekites was one of the major things that he saw. And there were different speculations as to exactly what the text has in mind here. But the main idea is that Yitro shows up and sees Israel and hears about the miracles that God had done. And all of this conspires in his own mind, and he then acknowledges in the text that the Lord is the God of the world. Not pagan deities, but the Lord is the true God. And so, in a sense, he becomes a convert in a rudimentary but meaningful kind of way. And so here you have him encountering not just knowledge about God, but right in front of him, the people of Israel who had escaped from Egypt. Who had ever heard of such a thing? And here he says, wow, wow. Look what God has done. He encountered God through the experience of seeing Israel and learning what God had done for Israel. It wasn't just some kind of head knowledge based on ancient events. It was an existential reality. And so the point I'm trying to make is that we need more than knowledge about him, but we need to know him. We need to relate to him. Now, in the same text, of course, we have the meeting. We have God meets with us at Sinai. And again, if you compare the discussion about lightning and thundering and the sound and all the different things, and compare it, for example, with the actual firsthand account of people who experienced the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, you find amazing similarities. And volcanoes are often called the mountain of God. In Japan, that's true. It's true in many places around the world. I don't want to debate the point. If you conclude it's different, believe me, it's perfectly fine. But it's my conclusion. But nonetheless, here we have our people Israel experiencing the miraculous and providential things at Mount Sinai of Moses going up and receiving the tablets and coming down. And this is more than just knowing about God. This experience of Sinai has permeated the collective consciousness of the Jewish people from that day to this. And if there's any experience in history that has preserved us as a people from that day to this, it is the profound memory, the experience of Sinai. Wouldn't you agree with that when you think about the tradition? Yeah, that's it. That is the biggie. And that's why over and over again we're called back to the Sinai experience, and that's why every Shabbat we, in a kind of sacred drama, reenact the Sinai experience during our Torah service. That's what's going on. So you have our people experiencing God. It's the experience added to the knowledge. Yitro also. Now let's talk about Isaiah a little bit. Let's talk about our Haftorah portion. There's a context to our Haftorah portion. We're reading in the book of Isaiah. It's chapter 1. And it begins with chapter 6, and it says, in the year King Uzziah died. So what's that all about? Well, you have to learn, turn to the book of Chronicles and Kings for that. And essentially what you had is a king who for many years did the right thing. He's spoken of positively in the text. However, he became, according to the text, prideful and arrogant. And you know the expression, pride comes before a fall. Yeah. He became proud and arrogant. And he decided to arrogate to himself a privilege that was not to be his as the king. And the privilege was this. He went into the temple and participated in the temple by burning incense on the altar. And that was forbidden. You see, the way the governmental structure of Israel was set up, and there are echoes of it in our own governmental structure, you had the separation of powers. You had certain roles that the king was to fulfill, but you also had different roles that the priests were to fulfill. And then the third leg of that stool, if you will, would be the prophetic voices, the prophets. And these three, with different roles, were supposed to complement each other so that there would be just government in Israel. You with me? You follow what I'm saying about this? Okay. The king was not supposed to get involved in the priestly worship. Because in those days, priestly worship and religion was real power, not in our society where we're a little segment of society, not right at the center. And the combining of the kingly role and the priestly role was not supposed to happen until a king who was a priest would one day come who would get it right, and that's Messiah himself. In him, the roles of prophet, Kohen, and king are mixed together. Well, but not before that. So there's this dramatic episode in the book of 2 Chronicles where the king, Azariah, is about to offer incense, and the priests show up and go, "Don't do it! Don't do it! Stop! Stop!" And he says, "Who are you to tell me what to do?" And he offers the incense, and all of a sudden, someone there notices a bump, a white bump on his forehead. And it was Sa'arat, commonly translated leprosy. And soon he was covered with leprosy. And a leper, according to the Torah, had to live in a different place. It was a kind of quarantining. And here you had the king in that different place. All right. All of that by way of context. Isaiah lives in this time of political disequilibrium. A time when the king had done great things, but now was marginalized. Power vacuum, all kinds of bad stuff. And we know from the book of Isaiah, from the first 39 chapters, that Israel was not in good shape in terms of how we acted. And much of the book is a series of judgments that God pronounces. And we see that in the chapter that we read, that Stacy read to us a little while ago, Haftarah. Isaiah is called by God to tell Israel, "You better get your act together because judgment's coming." How popular would that make somebody? Not very. Not very popular. Prophets are not popular people. I have a feeling that it took a certain temperament and they were probably difficult to live with, you know, anyway. But that's another whole story, and that's my surmise. But it was a tough thing to do. And so what does God give him? He gives him a supernatural encounter of God. In a kind of vision, when he says, "I saw the Lord lifted up," and he was in the heavenly Mishkan, if you will, the heavenly temple, and he's experiencing angels and God who is both revealed and concealed by the smoke. You know, that's a very interesting dynamic about God, revealed and concealed. And he is absolutely dumbstruck by the scene, as he watches angels sing Kadosh, 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 Adonai Tzevaot, Meloko Ha'aretz Kivodo, that we say it, we reenact it every week here at services. We're part of it. We do it. That's why I want you to be here early, so you're not late for that reason. And so he sees all this, and his experience is, he's just dumbfounded and feels utterly inadequate to be in God's presence. We could relate to that, I mean, too. You can imagine. So there's a symbolic gesture that an angel touches his tongue with a coal and thereby expiates his sin. And this whole experience, this supernatural revelation of God's presence, is what is intended to empower him so that when he comes out of it, he's able to do the hard job. You see, it's more than knowing about God. He knew about God. He was Isaiah. But he had to have the experience. Let's consider for a few minutes the Besorah portion. Now, in the Besorah portion, you have, and it's, in one sense, it's so human and so relatable. And in another sense, it's so other, you almost don't know what to do with it. You have Yeshua in our Besorah portion and his brothers. And he had brothers. And the most famous brother, what was his name? Does anyone know? You win a cookie. Yaakov, yeah, Jacob, or James in the English Bible. And but we don't know the names of his other siblings, but apparently his parents had a number of kids, and his father seemed to have died earlier because we read about his mother, but we don't read much about his dad after the birth narratives. So you have Yeshua and his brothers, and they're in the Galilee, but now is the time, three times a year, you're supposed to show up in Jerusalem. And it's Sukkot, and it's one of those times you're supposed to show up. So we read it. Phil read it to us before. His brothers say, "Well, you go into the feast. You know, if you're really who you claim to be, you really want to show the people there the kinds of things you've been doing around here, right, bro?" It's so human. And yet, what was it like to live with someone who was the Mashiach? It's so difficult to imagine. There's echoes of the Joseph story, but that can't do justice to what it must have been like for that experience. But the text says that his brothers said this because they did not at that point believe in him. And only later on does Yeshua go to Jerusalem. He goes clandestinely, shows up in the middle of the feast, etc. But let's talk about this brother, Yaakov, for a minute. You see, it took something really big. It took an encounter, a supernatural encounter, to convince him that his brother was, in fact, the Messiah. He couldn't see it. He saw the miracles. There's no question about that. But he was not able to put it all together until he had an encounter. And it's described in the first letter that Rav Shaul, the Apostle Paul, wrote to the Corinthian believers. And in the first part of this chapter, called chapter 15, it's all about the evidence for the resurrection of Yeshua, the historical reality of it. What he does is he catalogs all the people who had seen Yeshua. And he starts out by saying, look, there are more than 500 people who experienced seeing Yeshua after his resurrection. And he says, some of them have fallen asleep, but the majority are still alive. And the implication is, if you doubt it, go ask them. You can ask them, you can cross-examine them. You can find out if, in fact, this was just a religious myth, or if this, in fact, really, really happened. And then he goes on to talk about the different people who had seen Yeshua after his resurrection in the order of the appearances. And one of the last ones, the second to last one he mentions, is Yaakov. Yaakov appeared to Yeshua. Can you imagine what that had been like? Yeshua says, brother, it's me. This is after his death. Yaakov is just amazed by this. We can just imagine him just falling fainting. I would faint. He would just faint. But then he gets up, and we know from history, we know from the text of the Besorah, we also know from other ancient sources like Josephus, who you've heard of, that this brother became the community leader of the Messianic Jews. And he was a pious Jew. He took Jewish life very seriously, but he ultimately was killed by a high priest when the Romans weren't looking and blah, blah, blah. Now, he needed that encounter with God. The point is, we do too. Now, the thing about the encounter with God is that there are different kinds of encounters with God, and I don't like reducing things to one simplistic, single kind of experience as if that's it, because it's not it. Okay? Jethro's experience was different than Isaiah's, which was different than Yaakov's, and yet all of them were encounters of a very real kind. I believe that when we come here on Shabbat, if you choose to, now this is a choice you're going to have to make when you come in, if you choose to enter into the words, English if you need English, Hebrew if you're comfortable with Hebrew, either is good, if you choose to enter in, and choose to stop criticizing what you do or don't like, thinking about your week, thinking about this problem that you have or that problem, but you just say, no, I'm going to turn the channel. I am going to focus in on what's being prayed. You can have a kind of mini experience with God. That is mini compared to the kind of amazing ones we just read about. You can have it every day when you daven. And I really recommend praying every day, because it's not enough on just on Shabbat, but we're focusing on an encounter with God. And here's the way it works. When you daven, sometimes you're not going to feel much of anything. Is that bad, by the way?
No,
not at all. You can't over-orchestrate these things. You can put yourself in a position to experience them, but you can't over-orchestrate. If you try and make it happen, you kill it. You know? It's like romance. You can't over try and make it happen. It's got to be there to some extent. Okay. So, davening, and I know that I have moments often, like Verestikli when I'm linked, fill in, but other points that I'll tell you the points that I meet with God very deeply. Tekezena einenu b'shuvekel l'tzion b'rachamim, where that's the portion which says, God, return your presence to Zion. And I see Yeshua, and you know what I do? I kind of, in my mind, walk along with him a little bit. And I say, How am I doing? And he goes, well, you're doing good. I'm with you. You need a little work here and there, but you're okay. You know what I mean? And that's really the kind of sense I get, you know. But I'm talking about an experience with God. I had an experience that was an amazing one, and sometimes there are amazing ones, and I'll close with this. It was 1986, and Sue and I were with a fellow named Dan Juster, one of my good colleagues and friends, and we were in Kansas City at a big meeting of believers. It was not a Messianic Jewish experience at all. It was an evangelical Christian experience. But anyway, we were there, and the speaker was a fellow named Mahesh Chavda. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of him. Mahesh Chavda. I don't even know if he's alive anymore. But he was an Indian guy and a speaker, and he invited all of the pastors to come up front for a word of prayer. Well, you know, I don't view myself as a pastor. I view myself as a rabbi, that is a teacher, you know, in our segment of Israel. But I figured, good enough. And so I went down there, and he prayed for people. And as he was praying, many just fell right down on the floor. They just were overcome with some kind of spiritual power that was kind of evidenced or reflected through Mahesh Chavda. He would never say it was him doing it, obviously. But I've always been the skeptical type. I'm very, very keenly aware of group dynamics, collective psychology, you know, ever since I was a kid, learning about the Nuremberg rallies and how all these German people were just loving, you know, just these big rallies and everyone's involved and so excited. And so I've always had a fundamentally skeptical attitude about group psychology and about how it can be twisted and perverted and brought in a bad way. And, you know, the concept of the demagogue is the person who appeals to, you know, visceral ideas and stuff and gets everyone all riled up, and, you know, don't get near me with that because I don't like it. But anyhow, so as he was coming down the aisle and I'm watching all these people, I said to myself, look, I'm not going to fight anything that happens, but I am not going to fall down on the floor if on my own, and I'm not going to let anyone push me, I'll tell you right now. You know what I mean? No, but I'm serious. I'm not going to let that happen. I don't care if 4,000 people are watching. I don't care. I am not a phony, and I am not going to fake it, period. He was about 6 feet away from me, didn't come near me. I'm out like a light. Out like a light, on my back, could not move, and I experienced a profound experience of the love of God, not like any other time in my entire life. No joke, 1986. Couldn't move. It was just being bathed in a sense of absolute love. And I couldn't get up. I don't know. It was 5 or 10 minutes. I'm not sure. Then I just got up, went back to my seat. That was it. Didn't know what to do with it. It was just like amazing. But it was, for me, an experience that was very meaningful of the reality of God's presence. But there are a lot of different ways it can be experienced. I just want to leave you with this thought. And I'm real serious about this. I have a very, very deep instinct that the United States and the world is heading into a tough period. Doesn't mean it's going to be tough for everybody, and I'm not claiming anything other than that, but I do believe it. And I struggle with it because I think to myself, what right have I to say that to you? A, I could be wrong. I'm not a prophet in that sense. I think I do have something of a prophetic gift, but not something that I want to land on with 2 feet to say to a group. On the other hand, I feel a certain sense of responsibility that my job is to help you prepare for whatever may come. So why don't we leave it this way? Maybe everything will be great, but maybe I'm right. So leave it there. Good enough. But I'm telling you that whether it's a worldwide phenomenon or national or just in your own personal lives, that is the kind of difficulties that send you reeling, I just want to tell you, you need a sense of the reality of God's presence, not just abstract knowledge about him, if you're going to make it with joy. You follow what I'm saying? It's not just knowing about him. You've got to put yourself in a position where you experience him, and I think that can grow, and it can be punctuated with some amazing experiences, of course. I think we should ask God for those amazing experiences without getting hung up and over get into some kind of hothouse mentality. But nonetheless, I think that for you and me, the trick for the future is going to be to walk with God, and that's going to include, yes, knowledge and learning, of course, but it's also going to be asking him, God, make yourself real to me. May I experience your presence, not only know about you. And I think if we approach life that way, whether things are terrific or whether they're tough, I think we're going to stand strong, and I think we're going to make it, and I think we're going to be able to continue in life without giving into all kind of self-destructive patterns to anesthetize ourselves from the disequilibrium and trauma. And I think we're going to do just fine. So, seek God. Seek his presence. And I think if you do, he'll grant it to you. Shabbat shalom, everyone.